visual cultures, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College and Temma Kaplan of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Temma Kaplan is here to discuss her new book, Red City, Blue Period, an account of politics and culture in early 20th century Barcelona. Before that, Marianne Hirsch will talk about family pictures and cultural narrative.
Photography's social functions are integrally tied to the ideology of the modern family. The family photo both displays the cohesion of the family and is an instrument of its togetherness. It both chronicles family rituals and constitutes a prime objective of those rituals. As photography immobilizes the flow of familial life into a series of snapshots, it perpetuates familial myths while seeming merely to record actual moments in family history.
Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about family pictures and cultural narrative. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In our world of MTV and high-tech journalistic video, the humble family photograph seems quaintly out of step. But according to Marianne Hirsch, a professor of French and comparative literature at Dartmouth College, family photographs are important because although apparently simple, they help to reveal the complexities of our individual family roles. In this sense, family photographs act as a script in which the familial gaze becomes a window on autobiography, love and loss, power and powerlessness. I asked Marianne Hirsch to explain.
Well, some people have argued that when George Eastman in 1888 invented the Kodak box camera, when he revolutionized the technology of how pictures were taken and also the context in which pictures were taken, that he did so with the family in mind. And what he had in mind is that families should record their own, be able to record their own lives in their own ways. Since then, of course, photography has become a kind of ideology of the familial, a way that families remember their lives, their life stories, and tell their life stories to each other and to the world. And some people have even said that our photographs, our albums, are our most prized possessions. For example, the story that I found very moving was in the Oakland fire, when people had to evacuate their homes, they left with their family albums.
Right.
Now, photography is therefore not an anti-narrative medium. It's not a static medium. It's a medium that enables us to tell our stories.
What do you mean by the ideology of photography? Does that hint of some dark, rather conspiratorial or uninvited element as we look at the pictures that we make of our families?
Well, I think that photography can help us to see how ideology functions. Because ideology is always invisible. What happens is that we have a kind of monocular view. There is a camera lens, and the camera lens and the viewer are in the same position, unlike in film where there are many different cameras and we see many different things at the same time.
See.
We see only one. And in that sense, we can see how we recognize ourselves and how we accept what society, what the images that society projects onto us.
Right.
And the familial is one such image.
But again, this word ideology hints of power relationships, that is to say the way men interact with women, the way parents interact with children. Do I hear the word, for example, manipulation, things of that nature hovering above the conversation?
Yes, I think that the camera has been seen as an instrument of power and has been used as an instrument of power. Think of how the police uses photography.
Right.
As a way to control a behavior, really. Think of how anthropologists have gone in to record the lives of other cultures in ways that the other cultures could not look back. So I think that power relation is always there.
What about an apparently innocent sounding phrase like the familial gaze, the familial look? How does that tie into these large terms that you're using here?
Well, I see it working. I think we have to make a distinction. This is the distinction that I make between the familial gaze and the familial look, because I want to take see power as much more malleable and multiple. Mm-hmm. The familial gaze, I think, is that ideology of the familial that we, in some ways, we all subscribe to, that we see when we construct ourselves for a photograph in a familial context. We put on certain masks, we participate in certain conventions, we construct ourselves in certain ways. I might construct myself as what I think a mother is supposed to look like, or a daughter or an aunt is supposed to look like, right? Uh-huh. That's the familial gaze. The familial look, I see the family as functioning with a series of circulating looks, where we confirm each other in our roles, in our positions, by looking at each other. And that's a much more multiple and not multiple process that doesn't just participate in power and powerless victims and a process of victimization or oppression, but in which we all collaborate in some ways and say and confirm each other by saying, yes, you are the mother. Yes, you are the son. Uh-huh. Right?
What does it have to do with feminism? I mean, you are, I think it's fair to say, one of the leading theorists when it comes to the relationship of, here you're looking at pictures, photography, families, the idea of narrative. How does feminism enter the mix?
Well, as a feminist, I think it's very important to look at how family functions and in some ways to try to loosen the strings that family has had and the closed circle of this familial process.
All right, now let me stop you for a moment. One of the accusations floating in the general culture, in the mm-hmm. popular culture, is that feminists hate the family, that feminists are attacking the family. I want you to address that question for mm-hmm. me here.
Well, I don't think the feminists, there have been the opposite accusations too, that from women who may not have chosen to be mothers, that feminists have been too mother-centered. Uh-huh. So I think we're getting both. I think feminists have to be interested in the family, because the way that women are gendered, the way that men are gendered, the way masculinity and femininity are constructed in our culture is through the family. So we have to understand how the family works. But it seems to me that as feminists in a political world, we also have to enlarge the family. And what I am trying to do through this work on pictures is to enlarge the family album, to make space in it for many different kinds of families and many different kinds of relationships.
Now, one of the things that you're looking at in your scholarship, Mary Ann Hirsch, is a couple of books by a cartoonist, a man named Art Spiegelman, won the Pulitzer Prize for Mouse and Mouse 2. It's a big order, but tell me, economize an answer for mm-hmm. me and give me a sense of why you're interested in cartoons, for goodness sake, and taking them seriously as cultural commentary, and what they have to do with pictures and families and loss and narrative. That's a big order.
Well, Art Spiegelman's work Mouse is not just a cartoon. It's a survivor's tale, a story of his father's survival in Auschwitz. And the reason I'm interested in it is because it's a second generation story. It's a story of a child of survivors who has only mediated access to the reality of that survival in the concentration camps.
How do I remember? That's what he's asking.
How do I construct my history? And how do I tell the story with only fragments that are left? Fragments, snippets of conversations, some oral history, oral testimony, and a few photographs. And I think it's, I saw an exhibit that was put together about his work on Mouse, and he used photographs of Auschwitz in order to draw these pictures that may seem completely unrealistic, mm-hmm. really completely mediated.
At the beginning of the second book, he has a photograph of the younger, actually the older brother that he never met. Help me with the pronunciation, Rishu?
Yes.
And here's a picture of a little boy who comes to us in the form of this, the opening of the book. And Spiegelman, the cartoonist and the character in this second book, Mouse 2, says, how is it possible to have a sibling rivalry with a snapshot? Unravel that one.
Yes,
for me.
I think this is the power of family pictures, and I think the way he uses them in this book of drawings of mice and cats. After all, we have three photographs that emerge, and what I'm saying about them is that they jump out of the frame and they touch us and wound us in a way, precisely because they're juxtaposed with this other medium, with this low culture medium of the comic.
Right.
They jump out at us in a way that will not let us put the book back on the shelf without continuing to think about it.
Is your scholarship, Mary Ann Hirsch, a commentary on technology? because, I mean, here, you know, you began by talking about George Eastman and the photograph, and now we live in the video age. Mm-hmm. We live in the age of Madonna, not in the age of, mm-hmm. of the snapshot. Are you looking back or are you looking forward?
Well, I'm looking both, but I am sticking with the still picture and the way still pictures can nevertheless tell stories, because my background is in literature and I'm interested in how stories are told and how narratives and family structures in some ways are parallel to one another. But I'm also interested in how technology has intervened and has now structured the ways in which we tell stories in our modern age. Kathy Davidson has said, we live in a photocentric culture. We have Indeed. To take account of that. We can't fight it. We'd really have to see how that works.
Marianne, apropos of your comments about narrative, tell me about what's going on the current literary scene. A lot of writers are drawing on these themes.
Yes, a number of our most important writers today are casting photographers as their main characters and are also using pictures in order to tell the stories of family life, are resorting to the descriptions of photographs in their texts. I'm thinking of Marguerite Duras, of Jamaica Kincaid, Sue Miller, Ann Beattie. These are all writers who are focusing on photographers. On the other hand, we have in the world of art photography a movement into the domestic sphere, into the house. Photographers who are taking pictures of their families. I'm mm-hmm. thinking of the recent exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art called The Pleasures and Terrors of Domestic Comfort.
Right. Who is that?
This was an exhibit of many, many different photographers that was meant to be representative of what's going on in photography today. Uh-huh. And a number of photographers are actually taking pictures of their children, of their house, of their parents, of their spouses, and so on, and have made that the subject of their art.
Marianne, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. There is a very strong personal dimension at work here. As you look at family pictures, photography, narratives of loss, are you fearful of crossing a line here between being the dispassionate academic commentator and what, presenting us with a sort of genealogy of yourself? How about that?
Well, I think that one of the myths that we all hold on to is our uniqueness. And I feel that I really have to write about my own family pictures in order to write about this work. So I am crossing. My academic writing is now also personal writing.
Does that mean that your family gets nervous when you turn up with a camera in hand?
Well, they get more nervous when I turn up with a computer and start writing about the photographs. So I'm not a very good photographer, so they certainly don't get nervous about that.
Marianne, I want to thank you for this lively and fascinating description of your scholarship. You're spending the year here at the Humanities Center writing about family pictures, narratives of loss. You're a professor of comparative literature at Dartmouth. Let me mention your book here. It is The Mother-Daughter Plot, Narrative, Psychoanalysis, and Feminism. That ties into what you're doing now.
Grows right out of it. Thank you, Wayne. I enjoyed this conversation very much.
It's Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Visual cultures. Join me now for a conversation with historian Temma Kaplan. We'll talk about her new book, Red City, Blue Period, an account of politics and culture in late 19th and early 20th century Barcelona.
Shadow puppet theater resembled cinema. Sometimes lewd, puppetry was not considered cultivated, though like film, it could be arty. Unlike stage plays, shadow puppet acts were seen on a white screen in a darkened room, thus promoting the dreamlike state that morphine users sought, a sense of totality. Then, too, the experience of drifting into a fantasy world structured by images projected onto a screen was shared with a larger public, another parallel with the movies.
Temma Kaplan teaches at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Her new book is Red City, Blue Period, subtitled Social Movements in Picasso's Barcelona. Accordingly, Kaplan notes that the city was important as much for its love of art as for its resistance to political repression. Its nicknames, in fact, included City of Bombs and Paris of the South. In a cinematic overview, Tema Kaplan shows how Barcelona embraced populist politics and nurtured a diversity of artistic achievements. Her narrative moves from the city's cafes and brothels to its religious life and puppet theaters, which were a favorite pastime of many of the working people who populated Barcelona. I asked Tema Kaplan for a sense of the players and themes she describes in her book.
Well, among the most important players were recent immigrants to the city. These were country people who were coming to the city looking for work in the textile industry, very much like the American South. And what was happening to them is that they were living in slums in the city and they were disrupted in their lives. But, for example, going to puppet shows enabled them to see old friends, but also in the puppet shows, for example, the police would speak Castilian, although most of the peasants spoke Catalan. Uh-huh. And often there was both the devil and death who would appear at the end of puppet shows. And, of course, the devil spoke Castilian and death spoke Catalan, since death was part of life. The people included the factory owners, many of whom were very much interested in architecture and were the patrons of people like Antoni Gaudí, the famous modernist architect. They included painters like Santiago Rusiñol, who was a painter, a folklorist. There was a lot of reflection on their own culture, much as there was going on in Ireland at the same time.
This is what you mean when you talk about a symbolic landscape and the interplay between political ferment and expressive culture.
Exactly. People were shaping the visual life around them and giving it new meaning, and there were struggles over that meaning.
Tell me a little bit about nationalism. That's a very important word here. Give me a sense quickly of the interplay between the Catalans. Help me with the pronunciation here. We're talking about Catalan Spaniards and Spanish Spaniards.
Yes,
am I
although
right?
The Catalan Spaniards would never call themselves Spaniards. They would say they were Catalans. And of course, about 10 million people speak Catalan, which is more than speak Czech. They simply don't have a country. The Catalan, the peasants from the countryside all spoke Catalan. Uh-huh. Many of the urban people spoke Castilian, but in fact, in the 19th century, began to speak Catalan, publish poetry in Catalan, carry on poetry festivals in Catalan, and reintroduce Catalan as a language.
Do we associate automatically the idea of political radicalism with, therefore, the Red City, with what it meant to be Catalan?
Well, not exactly, because in fact, the Red City is really about the factory workers and the women in the neighborhoods who were benefiting from being part of a new urban landscape. On the other hand, they were really suffering enormously, since they had hopes and aspirations. Which were dashed, increasingly, they wanted a new kind of democracy, a direct democracy. Their employers didn't necessarily want direct democracy, but they wanted Catalan culture. Where they could unite was against Castile and the centralization of the government, which really robbed both groups of any kind of power domestically.
Unity may be too strong a word. Mm-hmm. There was a certain unity to what they did and the objectives they held in common. First of all, give me a sense of those players, from nuns to prostitutes to expressive artists.
To fruit sellers, yeah, to ironmongers, to...
It's a
well,
wonderful
I think
mix.
We tend to think of politics as being the work of politicians. Yeah. And in this view of politics, in fact, politics has to do with people trying to organize their social relations with each other. And so everyone is an actor. And I try to cast them on stage in the roles that they played and give them credit for the intelligence that they show over the years. Now, that doesn't mean they always work together or that what they do always seems to me rational. But for the most part, within the limits of their own interests and their own understanding of a situation, it is pretty rational. And what I try to do is understand what they think they're doing.
For example, were there prostitutes who talked to nuns in the sense of having an everyday exchange of ideas and I imagine conversations going on? Was it as crude and simple
as
that?
It was, in fact, as crude and simple as that in certain situations. For example, what is often not said is that nuns ran all of the social services. Now, this made people very angry sometimes, but there were no social services apart from those that nuns provided. They ran the orphanages. They ran the health clinics, if such as they were. They ran kitchens for nursing mothers. They ran the hospitals. They ran the child care centers. So again, if there were child care centers, if somebody took care of a working woman's child, it was either a member of her family or a nun.
So what you're telling me here, Tema Kaplan, is that implicit in this series of political experiences in Barcelona, you have an element of gender that is, well, unique is a dangerous word. It is certainly unusual. It's an early symbol of what's about to happen in politics worldwide. Am I right?
Yes. And I think as we begin to look at history as if it isn't only one story, but the story of multiple and diverse voices, we'll see more women. And I think that has been the trend.
Would you call this feminism? Let me get you to comment.
Yes, in some way. I mean, without a feminist movement, none of us would be looking. One of my critics once said she goes looking for the women. And I thought, indeed I do. How would I find them if I hadn't gone looking? And in most histories haven't looked for them and haven't seen them, because if we look in the traditional place, the political parties, the church organization or hierarchy, the trade unions, we don't see women in leadership positions, or the ones we see are so exceptional that they in effect function as men. If we look in at efforts of ordinary people to win control over the price of food or rent, then we find enormous numbers of women who act in the public realm around quality of life issues. If we looked more at the issues that seem to us new, quality of life, environmental issues, we'll find a preponderance of women in those efforts.
Now, you mentioned the artists, the artisans. One of the major names that figures in this scenario, this grand cinematic sweep that you paint in your book, is Pablo Picasso. Give me a sense of the role of this man, his art, and the politics of Barcelona.
Well, Pablo Picasso lived in Barcelona for 10 years, and then he frequently returned because his mother and his father and his sister lived there. His sister died in the late 60s. His oldest friends, all of whom lived into their 90s as he did, also came from Barcelona, and periodically, when he lived in France, came to visit him. So his tie to Barcelona was always very great. Now, I argue that he wasn't a political person in a traditional sense. He didn't belong to a party or so on, but he had a sense of us versus them, or the good guys and the bad guys. And I argue that that really comes from his experiences in Barcelona and carry through, because to the extent that he understood politics at all, and he wasn't primarily a political person, he understood it in the terms of debate in Barcelona.
Do you put him in this category of all art is political? There is no such thing as art which is apolitical?
No, I use him as I would a quilt maker or a puppeteer, as another witness with another kind of evidence about the texture of life in the city.
Your book has been called by one of its reviewers cinematic. Did you do that deliberately?
Yes.
Did you do this sort of unraveling kind of thing? I mean, a storyboard effect?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Because I'm trying to deal with how people think visually as well as in terms of words, I want to express a visual picture to people. And I have a number of pictures and color plates in the book, but that's not enough. I have to try to get my ideas across visually. And so what I try to do is paint a picture with words, and that's really the construction of the book.
Tema, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We're talking about your book, Red City, Blue Period. Will you be accused of politicizing history, preaching a particular kind of political message in your book?
I don't think that so much as I will be accused of writing a discontinuous history, which is what I have done. I say at some point that that I'm projecting a series of slides or showing a series of photographs. I think history and politics both are processes rather than things in themselves. And so if you cut into them, you take a photograph, you take a still photograph, you know that the person isn't still except for that instant. So what I will be accused of is not telling a continuous story. And I think that it's a whole new kind of history. I'm not trying to tell one story. I'm trying to tell many stories. And as we look more and more at diversity, we'll hear that we won't hear one narrative, but we'll hear many, many voices.
Well, Tema, it's an impressive story that you tell, and I want to thank you for your taking time here to contribute to Soundings. Your book, let me mention this, is Red City, Blue Period. It is published by the University of California Press. The subtitle is Social Movements in Picasso's Barcelona. Did you have fun writing this book?
I did.
Yeah, I take it that it involves some field work. You got to go to Barcelona.
Oh, I've lived in Barcelona on and off for half my life. It's a beautiful city. I urge people to go, even if they...
Well, again, Tema, thank you for coming by to contribute to Soundings. You are a professor of women's studies and history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. You are here spending a year at the National Humanities Center. Tema, thanks and good luck in your work.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to conversations with Mary Ann Hirsch of Dartmouth College and Tema Kaplan of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Tema Kaplan's new book is Red City, Blue Period, available from the University of California Press, and scheduled for publication in paperback next fall. Mary Ann Hirsch is at work on a forthcoming book about family pictures and cultural narrative. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 655. That's program number 655, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The center welcomes your comments. Next week, Useful Things Evolving. Henry Petrosky, a professor of engineering at Duke University, will be here to talk about his new book, The Evolution of Useful Things, an account of technology and culture. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Visual Cultures, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with Mary Ann Hirsch of Dartmouth College and Tema Kaplan of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Mary Ann Hirsch will be here to talk about family pictures and cultural narrative. Tema Kaplan will discuss her new book, Red City, Blue Period, an account of politics and art in Picasso's Barcelona. Visual Cultures, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.